What am I doing? Don Shields joins me. Don is an Air Force veteran, and he's a public health guy. And so he's joined us a couple times before, and it dawned on me the other day. You know, I haven't talked to Don in a couple weeks. Maybe I should call him and get him back on. So, Don, first of all, welcome back to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks, Mike. Welcome, and hello from the heartland.
Give me a weather report. How's the weather, and how's the river?
Well, you know, the river is down within its banks, which is good, and the snow in my front yard finally melted, so that's a good sign, and my grass is starting to turn green, so it's looking very hopeful.
There you go. There you go. I want to talk, and Don has been awesome in coming on, because to me there's things we see in the news, and then there's public health people and what they're advising, and then there's policymakers and what they ultimately have to decide in terms of, you know, being the people that connect the world of public health to connect the world of budgets, right, and enact policy. And it's not easy stuff. So let's talk about that. First of all, give me your thoughts on, as you've watched this unfold, give me your thoughts on how the nation has done in responding, and now as it starts to try to come out of this in different, you know, 50 different responses in terms of coming out. Give me your general thoughts on it, Don. How have we done?
Well, you know, last 5 weeks ago, two and a half weeks ago, as we talked, I said, testing is going to be key to this. And, you know, when you look at this and you look at what's going on, it's one thing to look at the statistics, and it's another to look at people you love and people you know, and you don't want them to come down with it. But I still think testing is a key. I think we are getting a lot better with that. I think we're getting a lot closer to where we need to be. I think there's a lot of maybe confusion with some statistics that are out there and people that are saying that the numbers aren't as high as they should be. But I do think we're getting closer to where we need to be. I do think there's some things, though, that we should pay attention to.
All right. So let's start with that. So what should we pay attention to?
Well, I think if we take a look at what are a lot of the plans about coming out of where we're currently at, you and I have always chatted about we need testing in order to tell us what's out there, what it's going to do. Is it rising? Is it getting slower? Is it, you know, are we more at risk? Because people want to know, how can I keep me and my family and my loved ones safe? So as I look at those plans, you know, I look, do we have hospital capacity? We seem to be having, you know, if you look around the country, it doesn't matter whether you're looking at North Dakota or California, we seem to be having hospital capacity to take care of the people that are ill. We seem to have a number of ventilators to take care of the people. And you and I chatted 6 weeks ago about what problem that would be. Personal protective equipment, the masks, the gloves, the things. You know, as I look around, I talk to infection control nurse friends that I know in the Seattle-Tacoma area. I talk to sister-in-law working in a hospital in Dayton. I look at what's happening here. It seems like we have personal protective equipment, maybe not enough. Maybe surge is going to be a problem. We need to make more, but we seem to have enough right now. Are we seeing reduction in the numbers of new cases and deaths, which a lot of the plans say, let's see that happen, and then we can open things up? I don't see that happening everywhere. So I think there are places in America where we probably could reopen. I think there's places in America where we are at risk. And I think a lot of what you and I chat about in the past and what we'll probably chat about today is how much risk are we willing to take for the safety of our loved ones and our friends. And how can we weigh that? Do we believe, you know, what's coming out of the federal government? Do we believe what the governors are telling us? Do we believe what the locals are telling us? Do we have to go with what we think? What's at risk and benefit? What I don't see is in most of the plans there appear to be, as you bring people back to work, you need to think of things like testing them for temperature. Now, you're not going to catch people who are asymptomatic or without symptoms, which are a number of people,
right,
but you'll catch people who are sick. And, you know, a lot of times people who are sick go to work because they need the money,
right,
you know, and maybe I'm not that sick, right? You and I've all done that, rightfully or wrongfully. We've all gone to work when we didn't feel good. you know, you look at GM and Ford, who are putting ventilators together on assembly lines in, you know, in Michigan. They test for temperature. They keep people 6 feet apart. They seem to have done pretty good. You look at people in Israel and hospitals where they've done the same thing. I don't see that happening here, and we've had some examples even in Grand Forks, LM Wind manufacturer, where they didn't do it. Now we've got an outbreak of 200 positives and 900 people.
Wow. Let me go through a few questions. Could you explain what herd immunity is? We're starting to hear this term out of studies done in based on Sweden's response to this. What is herd immunity?
Okay, there are herd immunity means that you have enough people that have been exposed to a disease in the community that the disease basically doesn't have enough people to get ill and pass it along. And that happens when 60 or 70% of your people have immunity to what the disease is that's going around, whether it's chickenpox, whether it's measles, mumps, whether it's swine flu, whether it's coronavirus. And so if we can get the number of people through this disease or break the cycle with a vaccine and can get that up to 60 or 70%, basically you break the back of the disease and it can't spread. One big example of this that is easy to visualize, Mike, would be Ebola, right?
Right.
In Africa, when you have Ebola, that's a disease that goes into a village and it kills everybody and then has nobody else to kill and it just dies out. Okay? So in that case, the herd was 100%. But basically what we find in studies, you go back hundreds of years, what you find is that if you can get up to 60 or 70%, you don't have the repetition to pass it along and the disease kind of goes away. So if we can vaccinate, have 60 or 70% of the population with an immunity to this, we can kill it. We can break the back of this one.
Okay. The Swedish model, and if I go back, what Sweden did was they kept their schools open. They kept restaurants open, and they put into place strict social distancing and stay-at-home orders for the elderly and for people that they defined as at risk. Have you taken a look at that, Don, and what are your thoughts relative to that? Now, let me just tell you, they were Sweden isolated the elderly and vulnerable and limited gatherings to 50 or fewer, but kept open elementary schools, restaurants, and shops. So as you read about this and the concept of herd immunity, and then you look at the data in terms of the number of people that have been infected with the COVID-19 virus, there's been, in my opinion, pretty interesting discussion about what the data says and then maybe the overreaction of public policy. Well, let me phrase that right. The initial overreaction is warranted, right? The continued overreaction is not based on the data. Have you had a chance to look at Sweden's model, and would you care to comment on that discussion that is that gets bigger and bigger in the country every day? Because you know the economic pain, as you alluded to earlier, the economic pain in the country is huge.
That's right, and I think we need to get through this and get things open as fast as we can do, as safely. And I think the debate goes around, well, what do we mean by safe, right? And what things need to be in place for it to be safe. Yes, I have looked at Sweden as a public health professional and a number of countries and say, what did those countries do? What did Sweden do? What seems to be the outcome? If you take a look at Sweden, it has had 18,926 cases as of this week, and it's had a 12% death rate. But they have taken elderly, and they have kind of kept them away from the general population. How does that compare with someone like Germany, who have seen 158,000 cases, and they've basically had a lockdown, a very severe lockdown? They've had 3.9% deaths. How does that compare to South Korea, that has had tremendous testing and tracking? South Korea has had 10,700 cases, 244 deaths, 2.3%. And South Korea right now is hitting less than 30 new cases a day. So what's happened with Sweden? Well, Sweden has kind of been like the what you and I, our moms used to do when we were kids. Maybe you're a little younger than I am, but we used to have chicken pox parties. Now, a lot of people didn't have chicken pox, but a lot of them got together and said, I want to get this over with. All the kids are going to get it. Then they'll go on and they'll be protected the rest of their life. Right. So we had chicken pox parties. But in this case, coronavirus, with the outcome could be death. You don't want to have a party, right?
Right.
But Sweden's kind of doing the chicken pox party, right? And you see about a 12% death rate. Is that good or bad? Well, it's not good. I'd rather be in Germany with a 3.9% death rate.
So the argument, I guess, by Swedish public health officials will be our herd immunity will protect the rest of our population, where you guys have hidden from the virus, buying yourselves time, that your public health testing is going to catch up, and that is going to keep you from closing the distance between my 12% and your 4%, right? But right. When you come out of that, your number is going to continue to go up. Ours will not go up like yours will. And so at the end of the day, right, that's the bet, right? At the end of the day, we're going to be, right, on a par and suffer much less economic damage than you will, or we'll be relatively close to you. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair. You know, maybe they're betting on 12%, and that's the number we're all going to end up with. Most experts in literature and things that I've read and what I've seen in the 10 pandemics over 300 years is that our death rate from this probably will be a 1% to 2% if we do it right and if we can break the cycle of this. So, again, from a public health perspective, if we can delay things long enough and do things smartly until a vaccine can come out, we won't have a repeat of Sweden's 12%. We'll have 1% to 2%. Okay, what is the offsetting economic harm for that versus Sweden versus the U.S. And as hard as it seems, you know, and I have people that I know and love that are not working right now, you know, I can replace jobs and I can supplement income, but I can't replace a life.
Right.
So I'd rather go with the 1% to 2%. And I really do believe, personally, and what I've seen, and you may have seen, the vaccine studies, we're getting a lot of good promising data and things happening with vaccines. And so it looks like within a year, I think very good things will happen and we can break the cycle of this thing.
Okay. I want to talk about if you were Dr. Fauci. I want you to be Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx here.
He's a bright man. He's a great man. You know that?
Right. You can. We're going to morph them together, and you can be both of them. What advice would you give if you had the president and all 50 governors, the governor of Puerto Rico and governors of Guam? So all 53 of those people are in one room. Knowing the diversity, you know, for instance, you know, New York City is not every city in this country.
Right.
And so to me, having his press conferences on every day, hearing him say to people, this is coming to your city, what New York City is going through, when in fact that was not true, I think was counterproductive to the way we have a little bit more mature view of this. But what advice would you give them in terms of as the nation attempts to come out of this?
I first would say, if I were Governor Cuomo, I would have said, this will be coming to you unless you do something different than we did.
Right.
Okay? And I think there are a lot of places in the U.S. that are doing things different than what New York did. Locking down earlier, having testing in place, doing some things that New York, and also because of things such as people being together on subways, people living very, very close together. It's not like being in the heartland.
Right.
So, okay, I'll say that. But what I would say if I were Dr. Fauci, what I would tell, you know, President Trump, I'd say, you know, it looks like all of the data from the University of Washington, John Hopkins, people that we're relying on for data and models and got bright people looking at it, looks like that between mid-April and mid-May, we're going to be on the backside of this first wave. We know we might have two to three waves. The second wave is less than the first. Third wave is less than the second. But it looks like in mid-April to mid-May, we're going to be on the backside of this and going down. At that point, are there places in America that we can open up wisely and put businesses back to work, take temperatures so if people are sick, they go home? We have testing in place so that we can test people and find those cases that where people don't have symptoms, and we could do contact tracing and isolate those people. We do that, I think we can reopen. But I think right now we're about a month ahead of where we should be to do it safely. So if you were to ask me what's my advice, I'd give it to you. If you say, what am I telling my friends and relatives, I'm telling them, even if your state opens right now, I would not go to a restaurant. I would not go to a theater. The risk is too high with what I see.
All right. And then what do you see that most what do you see in all of this discussion that most alarms you?
I see us going willy-nilly without science, opening things up in various states right now, even when I see death rates and infection rates going up. North Dakota, eastern North Dakota, it's going up. We're going to open up Friday. I don't understand why we do that. We should wait for it to go down. I see that in Georgia. So what bothers me and what concerns me is that we're going to open things up, even if the plan, say, is safe opening. That's a nice word, but it's not what we're doing. So I'm saying there's a mismatch between what people say they're doing safely and what I see with the data with rising numbers of people cases, and we should wait a few more weeks.
Got it. The what indicator do you pay most attention to? Because number of cases, how long is it from the time you would be exposed to the virus till the time you would show symptoms of this virus?
You know, I'm not a doctor. I do a lot of reading, and people who are friends of mine are doctors will tell me, they say it could be as quick as 2 or 3 days, or it could be 14 days or more. If you're not symptomatic, it could be 21 days. So I would say we're going to find out in Georgia and places like that in 14 to 21 days what their experiment showed.
Okay. Next question is this period between where we are today and when we have whether it's a treatment for it that would knock down the symptoms, and then a vaccination for it. If you were a small business owner, well, or if you were the head of public health in Los Angeles, what steps would you recommend to business owners that they should do on a daily basis at work in order to, you know, to keep their business viable? And let's just say we're just an office business. We're not a restaurant or a bar or anything like that, but we're an insurance company, or we're a financial services company where we have clients that come in. What procedures would you put in place? And we can see all of our clients either virtually or talk to them on the phone, so they don't have to walk in. So there'd be minimum walk-in traffic, but we would come there every day. What steps would you put in place? Were you king for a day?
Well, you know, I think the president's plan on reopening and his guidelines for employers, those are pretty good. Social distancing and protective equipment. Hey, I think we could do that 6 feet apart. Temperature checks. I think we can do that. We see GM doing that and Ford doing that. It seems to be working on their assembly lines in Detroit. We ought to be able to do that to every employee is going to work. If they have a fever, send them home. Testing, isolation, contact. Well, I don't see we have enough tests in place to do testing. There's a big problem there. By that I mean is that until last Friday, Mike, there was a big testing, drive-through testing here in Grand Forks for the LM, which are the wind turbine manufacturers and blades, where they were doing a drive-through testing for the 900 employees. At 4:15 in the afternoon, they had some extra tests, so they sent out a note on Facebook saying, if you are symptomatic and you can get over here before 5 o'clock, we will provide you a test. Well, that tells me we still don't have enough tests if we can't test people without symptoms. Now we're back to I have to have symptoms, and I have to have been exposed to someone who had coronavirus in order to get a test in North Dakota. Well, that's not good, because we're not picking up the people who are symptomatic or without tests. So testing is a good criteria on the president's list, but we're not able to meet that as employers right now. So I think employers should meet that. Sanitation, I think they can do. Disinfect common areas and limit business travel. So I think his initial plan for employers are really good. I don't think we can meet the testing criteria yet.
Got it. What do you say to people? I mean, this discussion about this is an overreaction. Given, you have schools like medical schools like Stanford, like USC, that have put out studies saying that this is far more prevalent in our data says that it's far more prevalent. You have, statistics from the state of New York that said that 40% of New Yorkers in their populations and the population they tested was 649,000 people. That had tested positive for COVID, so it's in our population in much greater numbers than we think, and so there's which means the mortality rate is much lower. The pushback on that I've seen. I think Dr. Birx initially, when asked about the first study I saw come out and that I saw her asked about was the USC study. And she said, well, we're concerned about those numbers because depending on what test they use, we believe there's still a fair number of false positive tests. Right. So the test itself is faulty and gives a fair number of positive results, which skews the data, which means the debate is skewed from the start. I'd be curious about, I'm sure you've seen that discussion, your thoughts on that.
Well, you've seen that discussion when we were testing for HIV/AIDS in America. You've seen that discussion when we're testing for a lot of things. And any test, you have false positives and you have false negatives, right? On a false negative means that I took the test, I came back negative, and I'm glad and I don't have the disease. And a false negative means, hey, it's telling me I don't have the disease, but you really do have the disease, right? That's a bad thing because you're thinking you're safe and you're not. A false positive means it's telling you have HIV/AIDS or Ebola or swine flu or coronavirus. False positive, it tells you have it when you really don't. So what I'm saying is that in both the cases of HIV/AIDS in America and other ones, we have a lot of times very quickly put in place screening tests where you don't get false negatives because you don't want people to have HIV/AIDS or have the disease and be walking around thinking they're fine, right? So you don't want a test to tell you it's a false negative. You don't mind if it tells you it's a false positive, and then you go on and you do a more specific test, one that looks at, the antibodies and ELISA, and it tells you that, your first test was a screening test. We knew that 5 to 10% of those positives were false. It tells you you had the disease when you don't. We do a more specific test, and it comes back negative. We know you really don't have it. So your ideal screening test doesn't tell you false negatives. It tells you maybe false positives, and you do a second test that's a little better test.
So
I look at the false positives and false negatives. So in this test, you're right. We have tests that have different rates, and in the antibody tests, different rates of false negatives and false positives. We've got to be careful.
Okay. So the more studies that come, the thicker that the data set becomes, and then we'll be able to draw better conclusions relative to this. All right.
I think it's not the more people you have in there. What it is what is the quality
of the test,
of that antibody test? What is the quality of that coronavirus test?
Got it. So in the last 5 minutes we have, Don, what about this have you seen that you found extremely interesting or that you found extremely disturbing as you've watched this thing kind of unfold? And it, you know, obviously it has, you know, the attention of the world, and for two reasons. One, the economic impact. I find it, I want to say almost disingenuous that, you know, you see people that are millionaires going on TV and tell everybody to stay at home, you know, and, you know, 52% of the country lives paycheck to paycheck. Well, they haven't had, you know, I think we're going on our fifth paycheck. Now, $1,200 doesn't replace that. And what is going to be the remedy for them? And so to me, there's a huge price economically and in real terms. You know, we've seen, you know, doctors go on television and talk about domestic violence, child abuse spiking, alcoholism, suicide. And so there's – so this is a really serious debate across the country. And the second subject, I don't – is so far down the line, it's probably not even worth mentioning. But your thoughts on something that you found either disturbing or something that's grabbed your attention in all of this?
I think one thing that is good, and that is I think people are being pretty compliant and trying to do the thing that's in the best interest of them, their families, and their neighbors. I think that's very good. I think things that are disturbing is I'm really concerned about what I see from, say, the University of Washington that says with this opening up, we're going to see not 67,000 deaths. We're not going to see – now they're projecting 74,000 deaths, and they haven't taken into effect some of the states like Georgia and North Dakota, other places that are reopening. So that number will grow. I don't want any of my loved ones and friends and family – I really don't want anybody to be in that 74,000 number. So that is disturbing to me, and I think we could get there if the government supplements income from people who are laid off, and we can take the next month to put coronavirus testing in place and antibody testing so we can get a safety factor where the benefit, I've got antibodies or I've come down with this and I've now recovered, get those people back to work. I know I'm a little bit – my risk of getting is a lot lower. I may not know everything about this disease. My risk is lower. I'm ready to go back to work versus – rolling the dice and saying, I don't know what it is. I don't know how many people out there that are catching this disease right now, and I can't isolate them because I'm not testing for them. So that really concerns me greatly when I think we're probably within a week or within a month or so of being able to get there.
So your recommendation to me as the president would be we need to more specifically target our aid to those most impacted financially to this so that we can buy ourselves another month. And as we hopefully close down the testing gap and then begin and then you would be more comfortable as that testing gap closes down in opening the country.
And I would go a little bit further and say, people who are out of work and don't have a medical plan because they're not employed, let's give them coverage for medical care during this period of time when if they get sick, there's a $50,000 bill sitting there waiting for them and they have no medical insurance. Let's supplement their income so we can replace what they would have got if they were working, but we're only going to do that until we reopen, and then they have to go back to work.
Right. All right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you today that you want people to know?
Well, I think we need to be a little bit careful of people who use voodoo statistics, and we need to be careful of how they present those. Voodoo statistics was a term statistics professors I used to know in my master's degree program would say, you're taking data that you're putting a numerator, and the numerator is not the right data that you should be using when you have the denominator. And by that I mean is that when people talk about numbers of deaths, the numerator should be numbers of cases. Because if you use anything but numbers of cases, you distort the data and you can't rely on it to make scientific conclusions.
So if you're going to use the data, use the right data and make sure you have it footnoted.
Right. And I'll give you just a real quick
30-second
example. Mike, you don't have coronavirus, right?
Not that I know of.
Right. So your chance of dying of coronavirus is zero, right? You don't have it. You can't die of it. Zero.
Okay.
But a lot of people would say, no, Mike, your chance of dying of coronavirus is the entire population of California, not just those people who are positive, right?
Right.
But the entire population of California divided by the number of people who have come down with the disease. And so your chance of coming down with the dying of coronavirus might be 0.02 or 0.03. No, it's not. I mean, you have to come down with it before you can die of it. So when you got to be very careful what number they use in that numerator. It's not the population of California. It's the number of cases. And I think we can all say that we're not sure what that total number is. We're probably understating the number that's there, but it's not the whole population of California. And therefore, the outcome, the number you get saying your risk of dying is 0.03. No, your risk of dying right now is about 4%. You come down with it in California, about 4% of those people are dying. We think the real number will probably be in the 1% to 2% range. So what I'm saying is voodoo statistics is changing that numerator and going away from numbers of cases to population of California, the population of the United States. You're not able to make a scientific conclusion with non-scientific data.
Got it. What about the other term I've learned is comorbidity factors. It seems like in every study that I see that 90-plus percent of those who ultimately die of this virus have either one or multiple comorbidity factors that works against them. Your thoughts on that? Is that just virology 101? You know, your system's weaker. You have mitigating factors all to the negative that put you in a very, very risky position as your health as a human being.
Well, you know, I think as the reading that I do, the people that I talk to keep telling me and say, well, when you have those other comorbidities, diabetes, hypertension, heart issues, and it's pretty easy for us to envision cancer treatment, right? Because your immune system with cancers, you kind of try to take away the cancer when you basically kind of kill the immune system and have to rebuild it. So as your immune system is impacted by diabetes and high blood pressure and those things, your chance of it of reacting to fight this disease is less, and therefore your chance of dying goes up.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, always appreciate your time, and I'm happy that your lawn is greening up nice, and hopefully in the not too distant future we'll be through this. But let me read you an email, Mac. I'm curious about what Don thinks relative to this thing coming back in the fall. Dr. Fauci's spoken about that here a number of times in the last few days. Could Don explain how it will come back? And is it typically worse, not as bad, in a second wave? So first of all, so the summer, just the heat, wipes these viruses out? Why does it take the summer off?
You know, for flu, it clearly does. And there's some indication from things that I've read, people I've talked to, that indeed will have some impact on it. The other thing is in the summertime, we leave our homes and we're out there in the outside and we're social distancing ourselves from other people. So we naturally get some protection. In the fall, we kind of get back together in school. And hey, we all know that schools are perfect little incubators. The kids all come home with runny noses and coughs, and we all come down with what they come down with. So we know that as you get together in school and you get together inside, that you're going to incubate this. And so what we've seen for 300 years with 10 pandemics is you have multiple waves. You have usually three waves, and in the three waves, it kind of builds you up to about a 60 or 70% herd immunity. Well, we're going to try to break that with a vaccine, but let's say, yes, we are going to have a second wave in the fall or winter, unless we can get a vaccine or a treatment to break the cycle. And we'll probably have a third wave next spring, early summer. And if you go through history, we've seen the second wave is not as high or bad as the first wave. The third wave is not as high or bad as the second wave. That's historically what we've seen.
Well, and that would make sense given our awareness, given hopefully some of the treatments that will make a dent in whatever X percentage your state has relative to mortality. It would seem that we would all be better prepared. We'd get to the hospital quicker. We would all understand that. So that would make sense.
And I would certainly hope that promising vaccines like what you see at Oxford and in the UK, that maybe it'll be available later this end of this year, and you can give it to health workers and give it to the elderly, and we can maybe break the cycle of this within 12 months.
All right, sir. First of all, thank you very much for your time this morning, and all the best to you and your family, Don. Thank you.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate chatting with you.
All right. There you have it. That is Don Shields. He's a veteran of the United States Air Force. And Don was the director of public health in Grand Forks, North Dakota, when I was a city member of the city council. And as professional as they come, and as measured and articulate as you hear him every time he comes on. So wonderful guy. We're gonna take a break. And more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.